Enter, if you dare.
Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the US of A, and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how's it going, sir?
I am well.
Excellent. And in the state of Massachusetts?
Hey, everyone. This is Abe.
Abe, how are you?
I'm still breathing.
Excellent. We do have two other co-hosts. However, they are unable to attend tonight. One is on a school trip. He's a high school teacher, and it's a five-day trip that he's taking with students, so he won't be with us.
That's a bastard.
Yeah. I'm assuming it's optional. I don't know, but he must get paid for it, too. I don't know.
Yeah, so, he always volunteers.
Yeah. And then the other is a Chrissy.
It's almost like he cares or something.
Indeed. Co-host Chrissy won't be able to join us tonight because she has a book launching party. So hopefully they'll be back sometime in the future, most likely next week. But that's all I got there. Just for new listeners, who we are Dark Discussions Podcast, where we talk about genre film weekly, critique, and review. So horror, sci-fi, fantasy, thrillers, techno thrillers, mysteries, grindhouse, midnight movies, art house, cult films, and whatnot. And we try to talk intelligently about a genre that deserves intelligence. You can reach us at darkdiscussions@aol.com or join our Facebook group, Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group. Also, you can listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, darkdiscussions.com, or anywhere podcasts are found. And we come out pretty much weekly. Let's see. So, Eric, what else can people do on DarkDiscussions.com?
Oh, they can do a bunch of stuff. We've got links all over the place to friends of the podcast, other podcasts, other artists' pages that you can go visit, all on the right-hand side of the front page. We also have some links up at the top. Excuse me while I choke on my own saliva. Jesus. One of those links will take you to all of the back episodes of not only the Dark Discussions podcast, but all the spinoff podcasts, such as You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, Bullets, Brothels, and Bots, and American Gods, all available for free. However, producing the podcast is not free. So we have a link on the front page that'll take you to our Patreon account. Patreon allows you to support your online artists, like us, to help offset the cost of server fees, hosting, website maintenance, domain names, equipment, and all that good stuff. So if you care to support us financially, you can follow the link on the front page of the Dark Discussions website, or you can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions. For every $5 a month that you care to donate, you'll have the opportunity to submit a topic for us to possibly cover on the show. We take all entries and draw them on a quarterly basis. For more information, you can go to Dark Discussions or go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions.
Yep, that's right. And we do have one in the bag, Deathgasm, which hasn't been released yet because we're still working on editing that. Because
was in the dark days, right?
Yeah, the dark days. It'll come out fine and dandy, but it just takes a little longer than usual. And with myself and co-host Mike doing three podcasts every week now, until the end of American Gods, it's been difficult to edit the more challenging episodes.
Welcome to the club.
Indeed, because I know you're
the
doing
three podcast well. Club.
Yes. Also, we do have another one that's going to be recorded soon enough, which is Devil's Advocate, the Al Pacino, Keanu Reeves, Charlize Theron, and Connie Nielsen film. Mm-hmm. So your choice could be picked too. Now, we'll get into other house cleaning stuff at the end of the episode, but I think we'll probably talk about our episode or movie choice first. And let's see, Eric, why are we choosing this movie before we even announce it.
We are doing this movie because Mike is a stick in the mud and refuses to do anything involving Lars von Trier. But he's not here this week. So, we're doing it anyway. Tonight, we're going to be talking about the latest Lars von Trier film, The House That Jack Built.
Your house is a fine little house, Jack.
Are you allowed to speak along the way? I was thinking there might be rules.
Let me put it this way. Very few make it all the way without uttering a word. But do carry on merrily. Just don't believe you're going to tell me something I haven't heard before.
Maybe a mistake.
What was maybe a mistake?
Me getting in this car with you. You might as well be a serial killer. Sorry, but you do kind of look like one.
Take a look in the van, please, sir.
I'd be a bad guy if I said no.
Some people claim that the atrocities we commit in our fiction are those inner desires which we cannot commit in our controlled civilization. So they are expressed instead through our art. I don't agree. I believe heaven and hell are one and the same. The soul belongs to heaven and the body to hell. Think about all the things I've done in my life without in any way resulting in punishment.
Oh, so really, that's the reason how we got to this point.
Huh. It is. Mike did not want to do any Lars von Trier. He's not here, so we're doing it.
When was the last of his films that you've done on this?
I don't think we have. No. We've talked about Melancholia during.
Phil and I had a great appreciation for Melancholia, but Mike's just not a fan. So yeah.
Okay, well I see now.
Yeah, I think we did like a 10-minute review on our Best of the Year episode when Melancholia came out because me and Eric had it on our top 10 that year, but that's the only time we've ever really talked about any of his films on the podcast, except we talked about this one here for 5 or 10 minutes in our Best of 2018, because this film fell in our top 10. I forget what number. It was somewhere between 3 and 6, but it was considered by our Dark Discussions podcast one of the best horror films of last year. As Eric said, it's a 2018 film. And as Eric said, it's a Lars von Trier film. He actually wrote it as well, not just directed it. The film stars Matt Dillon in the starring role of Jack. But the film also has a large, well-known cast, even if they were more supporting rather than co-stars. And those people include Uma Thurman, Bruno Gantz, Siobhan Fallon Hogan, Riley Q, who's actually becoming pretty big right now and maybe the next breakout star along with Dakota Johnson, who's not in the film, just Riley Q is, Sophie Grabel, and Jeremy Davies, all pretty good character actors or former A-listers who are now character actors, but all are fairly good. And, of course, one rising star in Riley Q.
And Just an interesting note is that Siobhan Fallon Hogan was in the first Lars von Trier film I ever watched that turned me on to him, Dancer in the Dark. She played a small role at the end of that movie, but a very important one. So I had seen her before in his movies.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I saw that film, and I can't remember her role in it because it was like, I don't know, 20 years ago or something.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. It was a bad weekend that weekend because my appendix blew up. And I
ouch.
And I was having a fever, and I watched the film in a fever, and then the next morning I returned to the emergency room, and it was official that my appendix had blown up. Let's see. The cinematographer is Manuel Alberto Claro, who's a Chilean-Danish cinematographer. He's done pretty much all of Lars von Trier's films, Melancholia, Nymphomaniac, and what have you. A lot of folks involved are fairly known, at least if you're a follower, Lars von Trier. That's all I really got to bring up here. The film has received pretty much fairly good reviews. Oddly, it slowly has fallen because it was at a high point around 70 at one point. And
yeah, it's not there anymore.
No.
Yeah, it's about like 59, 54 right now.
Which is kind of interesting that happened. Its original run, it got had high reviews, and like a lot of films that played the festival circuits, like such as Cannes, this film got a standing ovation that was 10 minutes long, meaning they loved it at Cannes. So that's all I got there. And that's pretty much it. So I guess we can go around how we heard about this film and what we felt. Oh, yes, go ahead.
Phil, just one note before we do that, which is that I think some of the reasons that it's only gotten approximately half positive reviews is that a lot of reviewers feel that movies with objectionable material, such as rape or violence or anything like that, cannot be a good movie because of that material. And if you want to hear somebody talk about that in depth, go listen to the latest episode of Horror Corridor. Where Mr. Watson takes on the film, a Serbian film, and has a really great point of view on why it's still a great movie. Although it's one I personally don't care to watch, I appreciate the thought process he put into talking about it.
Well, and that's a good point that you bring that up, Eric, because as I said at the beginning of this episode, I said Dark Discussions talks intelligently about a genre that deserves intelligence. And as we've known, genre films, which include these questionable materials a lot, have always been poo-pooed by critics for some reason. And slowly but surely, genre films are now becoming more accepted and more mainstream. And those critics who still review films based off of their own objections aren't doing a service for critics or fans, because the point of a movie, a critic, is to review a movie and whether or not it is good, not if they find it objectionable. Also, one other thing is that Lars von Trier hasn't helped himself out, because he's the type of person that unfortunately has alienated a lot of critics as
yes,
well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Some
will even say that this film is actually a metaphor for his hatred of critics, but
think people that say that are probably self-important critics.
You may be right. Yeah. Abe, you were going to say something. You know what?
I'll get to my thoughts when we talk about our thoughts on the film.
All right. Well, either way, since I just asked you a question, why don't you just give us how you heard about this film and what your thoughts were?
So I heard about this film because I think I came across a trailer, that kind of, I can wear the film, but I never watched it. Until we decide to talk about it for this week's recording. It's a You know, I have no problem with films of objectionable content. I think they can be. I think objectionable content can be handled very poorly and make a film really shitty. But I don't think that those that kind of content alone automatically makes the film bad. This film to me felt like a button pusher film. That it was trying to throw as many kind of objectionable kind of bits of content and see what kind of reaction you get out of the audience. I think it's way too long of a film. I thought it was very bloated. 2.5 hours was way, in my opinion, was too much of a length. I think they could have really cut down on some of the tedious scenes and really tightened the pacing. I thought the cast really worked well. I thought Matt Dillon and Bruno Ganz did well in the lead roles, and I think the supporting cast did what they could with the small parts they had. It's not a film I enjoyed watching, not because of the objectionable content, but I just wasn't really engaged in what was happening. I might have, except maybe during the fourth incident scene. That to me had some of the stronger acting and performances and character interactions that kind of kept me interested. If maybe the film had more of that, I might have felt more connected, because for the other few number of scenes, I felt disconnected. A lot of the other characters are completely one-dimensional and underdeveloped. And Jack, I felt was interesting, but I never really got intrigued by him, that the journey through the film was all that grand. It's a film I'm very mixed on. It's not a terrible film, and it's not a film that should be cast aside just because it has, you know, severe content. You know, I mean, we've seen plenty of other films down the road with varying degrees of success handling such material. But for me, I wasn't all that impressed with this film. And as a whole, there were some things I did like. And I almost felt the last sequence was kind of... It felt like a completely different movie. The way it was shot and presented in comparison to everything else. It's a mixed bag for me. I liked some of it. I hated some of it. I was not interested in other parts of it. It's, you know, that's how it was. But overall, I think it's interesting. It could be interesting to watch for certain people, but I can understand why some people might not be all that impressed either.
All right. Very well. For me, I heard about the film. It was one of those things that slowly built up just for the fact that it's a Lars von Trier film. And so he being so high profile, even if he is more of an art house director than a mainstream director, he's pretty much as famous a director as anyone. So I knew about it as it was coming. Also, to hear that he was doing a serial killer film piqued my interest as well, because I enjoy thrillers. I enjoy scary films that are more realistic than supernatural anyway. And so that interested me. And then when I heard that Matt Dillon starred in it, he had always been one of my favorite actors back in the 80s and 90s, that it was interesting choice to see him get a leading role. Since the last time I had seen him in a leading role was the film Crash, and that film is now probably over 10 to 12 years old too. That's how I heard about it, just through the build up that came with the film as it was slowly coming to release date. My personal opinion of the film, I thought this film is absolutely fantastic. The acting is absolutely out of the world. When we talk about films that are overlooked for Academy Awards that happen to be thriller, art house, or horror, this is an example of a leading man that was overlooked, similar to the film Next Week that we're going to do where people were overlooked because, again, art house horror. And we'll talk about that film next week. With that praise, you can gather that the acting is good. Direction-wise, obviously, Lars von Trier, he's a master. So it really comes down to a couple of things that Abe said, which is, are you able to enjoy a longer film than usual? And a longer film that isn't just a thriller, but more also trying to say things through the character's mental state and also metaphorically, as Abe mentioned, through the final act being a bit different. I would say that, well, actually, if you like Lars von Trier, then you're going to like this film. So that would be the first thing. If you don't, then it really comes down to whether or not you like art house horror or not. Because even though it's a serial killer film, the way it is presented with the narration and whatnot, it's more art house, even if it does have all the buttons that Abe and Eric mentioned. But I would say it's a high recommend. And the reason the two of us who saw the film last year gave it such good reviews that it actually landed on our top 10 when we aggregated everything together for Dark Discussion. So high recommend. Eric?
I think I first found out about this movie when I was flipping through news articles on Flipboard, as I do every week to try and find stuff to talk about on the Askansity podcast with Dan. Dan is actually a huge Lars von Trier fan. Like, I personally think to an unreasonable degree, but he loves Lars von Trier. So I saw the article about Lars von Trier doing a movie about a serial killer, and I was like, I'm in. And I sent him the link. He was like, I am. So as soon as it showed up on iTunes, we watched it together. And I'm closer to Phil on this than I am to Abe. I think this is a very good movie. But here's the thing. I was poking fun at Mike a little earlier, but I can't too much, because when people say they don't like Lars von Trier, I get it. I can totally see how the way he does things and the stuff he produces is not for everybody. And I even understand the comments that Abe was making about the movie, even though I enjoyed it more than he did. I totally see where he's coming from. For me personally, even though I'm generally not an art house film kind of guy, the way von Trier does it, some of the images he puts on the screen at the end of this movie and in Melancholia and in Antichrist are just some of the best looking images I've ever seen on screen. So I don't think anybody can dispute his skill technically as a filmmaker. I think it's more the subject material that people have issues with. And as Abe mentioned, this is a longer movie. I don't mind long movies. Some people do. So I thought the acting in this movie was great. It was a little long, but and the whole Dan, well, I watched it with Dan. He's very well read and has studied philosophy, so he was totally into the stuff that relates to Dante's Inferno and was totally grooving on that. I didn't really get that so much, but I still appreciated the visual images I was seeing on the screen. I enjoyed the first half of the movie more than the last half of the movie because there's more a lot actually going on. And overall, I really enjoyed it.
All right, very good. So, Eric, do we have a wiki?
Wiki. Whoops, wrong tab. Here we go. All right. IMDb says, the story follows Jack, a highly intelligent serial killer, over the course of 12 years, and depicts the murders that really develop his inner madman.
All right, that sounds good. Yeah. Yeah, I'd go with that. So a couple of things. Both Abe, myself, and you, Eric, all brought up the length of the film. This weekend, The new Avengers film is coming out. I think it's called Endgame. Mm-hmm. And that's supposed to be a very long film, too, about it's the same length.
Pretty close to 3 hours. Yep.
Yeah, as this one. But a lot of people are going to go see that film and probably won't have any issues with the length of that film, even though it's as long as this film.
I think it has to do with the fact that the Avengers would be more fast-paced.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, okay, that's fair. See, for me, the long half-hour action scenes usually bore me to heck, while the talking... To hell.
That's better.
Because hell is involved in this film, so we'll...
It is, indeed.
Yes, it is.
Yes. So... that kind of, I get bored and, you know, ADHD comes, it gets involved and it's like, all right, I'm done. But a film like this, its length, doesn't do that to me because there's
a lot of fascinating.
Well, because they're talking about a lot of stuff that is interesting. It's similar to what Dan mentioned to you, Eric, with the philosophy stuff. I mean, just the vignettes between, the major set pieces, such as the shadow as the person walks under the light and then walks away. I mean, those things.
Cool. That was a cool sequence. I think that was one of the better ones, but I thought some other parts of it were kind of misfire for me.
Right. Well, and those are things that make the film interesting. It's making me think versus, a half-hour action scene that I'm sure is entertaining, but it just doesn't work for me. So the length, my point is that length doesn't matter
if the content's good enough.
Yeah. If the content is entertaining enough for me. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So,
and that's going to vary from person to person. You know, this is an example of how, you know, like you said, I definitely agree. If it felt for me that I felt there was a little more here that was needed. But it's interesting, too, I found out that this was actually originally announced as an 8-part miniseries in 2014.
Oh, interesting. Okay. And then it either fell through or he decided to change it into a motion picture.
Yeah. What it says here, it was announced as an 8-part miniseries in 2014 when the complete version of Nymphomaniac Volume 1 and Volume 2 were premiered at the Venice Film Festival. But in 2016, Lars von Trier had actually announced via a David Bowie-themed video on his official Facebook page that it would become a theatrical release due in theaters in 2018.
Okay. All right. So something between 2014 and 2016 made him decide to make it a motion picture rather than a television.
Which is probably why that there was so much more stuff being stuffed into here, because he wanted to get as much as he could.
Because right.
That's probably what was going on here. And that could have been actually kind of interesting as an 8-part miniseries. I thought that could have been interesting storylines and kind of different examinations through there.
Yeah, at the same time, with the material in the movie, where would that get released? Like, Shudder is the only place I can think of.
Right. Well, could HBO, something like that, be picked up there?
I guess, but are they going to work with Von Trier? Who knows?
Right. Well, right. I mean, yeah, everything comes down to money. And if the project doesn't seem good enough to get enough viewers to make money, then, yeah, that's a fair point, Eric. As me and Mike, co-host Mike for Dark Discussions and Searching for American Gods, what we've been saying on the Searching for American Gods podcast that we're recording now and the last episode will be out before this episode of Dark Discussions. We've been saying the same thing about that show, is that it's such a niche audience. How many viewers, how can it even survive the money they're putting into it? And there's only getting, 300,000 viewers that watch it. So this would probably be similar to that, which is only certain types of horror fans, because it's a niche type of horror film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I also think that Lars von Trier just tends to be long-winded in his storytelling in general. Like the last thing he came out with before this was Nymphomaniac, which was actually split into two volumes because it was so long. So I think that's just part of the way the dude rolls.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. And a lot of his shots, as we mentioned, Dancer in the Dark or Melancholia, we've already mentioned, those films have a lot of dragging. And when I say dragging, I don't mean slow, but dragging shots where they stay on screen for a long period. So scenes that most directors would cut after like 20 seconds, he mm-hmm. drags out to 3 or 4 minutes because mm-hmm. he
wants to.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's the easy way. The more polite way would be he sees more things that could be done.
Well, and the thing is, I totally respect him for making what he wants to make, and being like, this is it. You know, this is my thing, like it or don't like it. I made what I want. I totally respect that. And at the same time, I totally get like why there are people out there like Mike. They're just like, no Lawrence Strong chair for me. Thank you.
Right. And we got to give Mike credit because he has given Von Trier a few shots.
Uh-huh.
And he just came to the conclusion after 2 or 3 of his movies that they just don't work for him.
Right.
Whether or not that's a good thing to do, because you can always have a director that pulls a gem that you will like that is different than his other films, because each film is individually a different thing, a different animal.
Like Joel Schumacher and Falling Down.
Yeah. Are you Phil with Del Toro?
Yeah, that's the guy I was thinking of, exactly. I mean, I like the Hellboy films, but most of his other stuff just don't work for me. But I'm always willing to check out his films as they come, because each film is a different animal and could be something that, you know, fits my wheelbarrow.
Yeah, and you know, I definitely agree that this is a very niche film. This is definitely, but at the same time, I can see why it was made into a theatrical one as well, because, you know, it's, I do think the idea of miniseries could be cool, but I definitely see the risk and reward kind of situation that comes with trying to do something like that, especially with Von Trier burning so many bridges inadvertently or on purpose amongst the cinema community.
Yeah, right. That's an excellent point, Abe.
I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, were you going to continue that thought?
I was just going to say that the film basically got a straight to VOD release. I mean, it did.
Yeah,
play at some
it was
theaters.
In theaters for one day.
Yeah,
limited release back in November.
Yeah.
Only one day, really? Huh.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah, they released the director's cut for one day in theaters in November, and it was too far away on. Actually, I think it was on a Thursday night when we record this, so I couldn't make it. I was pleased that they have started selling the director's cut of this movie on Amazon. So I have seen both cuts, the theatrical that was released initially and then the director's cut that was released later. Which version did you guys watch?
Director's cut.
Okay.
I watched the shorted version, so whatever that's okay. called. I assume that's the theatrical.
Theatrical.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, having seen both versions, I can tell you that the differences I noticed were there was a little bit of gore added, and it wasn't significant in length, but it was significant in impact. Like each of the really gory scenes had like maybe anywhere from 2 to 5 seconds added to it. But what happened in that time was, whoa, all right, buddy. and then there's the one sequence, probably what Abe was referring to when he said the parts that drag when they're talking philosophy and everything, they totally extended one of those sequences with more stuff. Yeah. Sorry, Abe.
Not well. I mean, there are some discussions that were interesting, but my goodness,
It was that section where they start talking about the concentration camp.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was extended by, I think 1 or 2 minutes.
It felt like 30.
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's the thing, is that even though this is a quote-unquote serial killer film, it's really not. It talks about a couple of things. I guess it's a number of films. It's a serial killer film, but it's also a film that talks about how or why a person that happens to have behavioral health issues becomes a serial killer, and the justification of their thinking, because what they, how they think, they obviously think it's okay for whatever reason, and so it's a character study as a result. And then of course it has the big ending at the end, mm-hmm. which as Abe said, feels like a different movie. And you said, Eric, what you didn't enjoy as much as the first half of the film, which I'm thinking Dan may have probably liked it as much as the first.
Absolutely, he liked that part better.
Okay, yeah, there you go. And there's a lot of stuff staying there. And then of course there's the whole underbelly of what Lars von Trier was really trying to say. If you just boil away the plot and the characters and just go with the theme, what was the point of the whole theme? And I'm sure there's something there as well. So the film is definitely
multi-layered.
Multi-layered and thrown into horror just for the fact that it's a serial killer film. But I think that weakens the greater picture of what the film is supposed to be.
It kind of buries.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. you see the surface of what the film is, and there's so much of that surface of layer of it that you can't really get deep enough into actually seeing the core of it.
That's an excellent way to put it, Abe. Absolutely, I love that analogy. The surface layer versus what's really below it. Let's see. What other things do we want to talk about or bring up before we actually get into any plot details or anything?
I thought Matt Dillon was fantastic in this movie.
I thought he was very strong. I thought he was a very strong performance.
Yeah, I posted as a joke early January or February when they announced the Academy Award nominations for this past season. And I wrote as a joke, congratulations to Matt Dillon for a nomination for Best Actor for 2018 performance. And then I wrote in parentheses, oh, sorry, that must be an alternate reality. because, as usual, horror films seem to get overlooked, especially, it's just weird. The whole process of how they nominate is weird anyway, because like the other joke I put out was Toni Collette. Congratulations for her, and for Hereditary.
She didn't get nominated either.
And she didn't get nominated either, right? Yet, 2 years ago, both Shape of Water and Get Out, were the two big films that won a lot of stuff. So it's just, it doesn't make any sense. I don't know how that is.
I think it's not going to change unless the makeup of the Academy members changes. Yeah. The good news is a lot of them are old and they're going to die soon.
Okay. Yeah, I guess you could put it that way. Awards doesn't really matter because, if you really look at it, Cannes
is
arguably more important than Oscars.
It does matter. I understand where you're coming from, Phil. You want to dismiss the awards because horror movies don't get them. But they do matter to the people who are in the movies, because if you are nominated or you win, it is definitely a resume batter.
Well, that's true. However, someone like von Trier probably is more excited that his film, was a powerhouse at Cannes than the Oscars, right?
You're probably right about that.
It depends on what part of the country you are. Part of the world you were at, and what type of award ceremony you're looking for. If you're looking for,
sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I'm just going to say, quite frankly, there have been a couple instances at film festivals when people have been outraged at his movies, and I think he likes that better, honestly.
Yeah, I think you're right.
He seems to thrive on that.
Yeah, Antichrist, I think, was the one that really made everybody flip out.
And that's a rough watch, to be sure.
Right. Yeah, I've never seen that, but I'll probably have to.
Oh, man.
Yeah. I've heard some scenes.
There is one moment in that movie that's seared into my brain, and I wish I could scrub it out.
Is that the nailing or the staple thing?
No, it's the scissors.
This is I
didn't hear about this one.
No, I haven't seen this film, but everyone talks about that scene.
Yeah, it's whoa.
Okay.
If you watch it, you won't forget it.
Right, right. that's great. Yeah, I would agree. Matt Dillon was absolutely phenomenal in this. I mean, he's always been a great actor, but for whatever reason, he was an A-lister for a good number of years, even though he was never the top A-lister. He was always an A-lister. And then out of the blue, he just kind of disappeared for a bit. And again, maybe he was doing art house films, maybe he was doing stage, or maybe, who knows. But then he came roaring back in this film, and I don't know if it'll put him on the map for other film producers and directors to consider him, but I mean, it definitely brought him back into the light for me anyway, because it's like, oh my God, I forgot how great he was.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good call, Eric, about Matt Dillon. All right. Anything else that is non-spoilery that's related to the film of Von Trier that we want to bring up?
I think we should just get right into it.
All right.
Yeah, and if you don't mind, Phil, let's throw up a spoiler flag right now. And I've got Wikipedia open to this movie right now. And for some reason, I'm really enjoying the way whoever wrote this wrote it. And if you'll allow me, I'd like to introduce each section of the movie with the way it's written in Wikipedia.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to start with the intro, and then the movie's divided into incidents, and it numbers them 1 through 5. So I'm going to start with the intro and then continue with the description of incident number 1.
Before you do that, Eric, I just want to ask, Abe, what was incident 4?
That was the one with Simple.
Yeah.
So that's the Riley Q one, right? The blonde?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. Yeah, that's the one I thought you were talking about, Abe, yeah.
All right, so the story follows Jack, a serial killer with some artistic disposition, over the course of 12 years and depicts the murders that developed Jack as a serial killer. Throughout the film, he has side conversations with Verge in between the depictions of the incidents, most of which revolve around discussion of philosophy, ethics, or Jack's view of the world. Jack is driving down a road when he encounters a woman who needs to fix her broken jack for her car. He agrees to take her to his mechanic, Sonny. Sonny fixes the tire jack, but when they both return and try and fix the car once again, the tire jack breaks. The woman asks to be brought back once again. Jack takes the tire jack and kills her with it. He then takes her body to an industrial freezer he has purchased to store it away.
I don't
know why the way this is written cracks me up, but it does.
It's pretty much that. It's a bloody little incident that just happens in the end.
Yeah, that whole scene is interesting too, because, and he explains it in narration at points, where basically he wasn't planning to kill anybody, but he picks her up to help her out. She's rude as hell.
She totally deserved it.
Yeah. You know, she's definitely a piece of garbage. There's no doubt. And then he just snaps because being a person with behavioral health issues, obviously, to even consider killing her, being that type of person, he finally just snaps and he, as you mentioned through the description, Eric, clubs her to death. So,
well, and Uma Thurman is the actress that plays the woman in this segment. And Dan watched the director's cut with me too. And while we were watching it for the second time in the director's cut, he turned to me and goes, "Man, I forgot how much I hate this woman." Because she really does a great job of playing this
obnoxious,
super annoying woman.
Yeah.
And like when he takes her out, you're kind of like, yeah, you're kind of cheering for him because she's so just abrasive.
Right. And it's a perfect example of how the killing starts, because had he killed someone that was sympathetic right off the bat, I don't know if we would have been looking at the character the same way right off. You know, if in other words, if it was a child or an old man or just some nice lady,
which we'll get to,
and he just starts clubbing her, we immediately probably would have hated the character. Mm-hmm. But by making the person he kills an abrasive prick, it's like you said, Eric, it's like damn, thank God she's off the screen, you know.
Right.
So it's I think it was a smart move to do it that way, make us if not complicit, at least a bit like, you know, a breather, thank God,
type of thing. Right. And I also just want to mention briefly that there were points in this movie where I found Matt Dillon to look very much like Willem Dafoe, and I can't imagine that's a coincidence, because Willem Dafoe was in Antichrist. Was he in Nymphomaniac too? I can't remember.
I'm not sure.
Anyway, Lars von Trier has worked with Willem Dafoe. He seems to have like a type, and Matt Dillon fits that type. I just thought I found it interesting as I was watching this movie that he was reminding me of Willem Dafoe.
Yeah, I can see that, Eric. Yeah, the haircut, the whole thing, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The mannerisms, all that. Yeah. Go on, Abe.
Oh, I sneezed. That's all.
Okay. That's the setup. And then this is where we learn about Verge too. This person that we don't really know who it is, but he always is talking to him, and so we can assume that it's anything from he's in jail and he's talking to, you know, a psychiatrist in jail, or we could think it's just some split personality.
Right. Well, to make it clear to the listeners, what's going on is that the movie starts with a kind of a voiceover. And it's conversation between Jack and Verge. And then as the movie continues and they go through these incidents, they'll either talk over the incidents or they'll stop showing the incidents so that they can have a conversation about what just happened, or for Verge to make another point about philosophy or whatever it is. So Verge's voice, at least, is talking to Jack, with Jack throughout this entire movie, while he's telling him all about these incidents, which are mostly shown to us rather than told.
Yeah. Which is an interesting, good way of telling the story in a kind of back and forth conversation. Allows for some questions to be raised and certain things to be brought up, because this is the first, in a way, because Verge, we can get an idea from how it's opened that Verge hasn't heard these stories before, so it gives the character of Jack a reason to share them. You know,
mm-hmm.
It allows us to be recipients of these stories here.
Mm-hmm.
And what's even funnier is here is that we learn later that these stories are chosen from random, but Verge kind of picks up little bits of information that kind of paint a bigger picture of the character as a whole.
Yeah, I also felt Verge, even though I said it could be a split personality or something of that nature, the one reason I wasn't sure if it was maybe a psychiatric doctor at prison or in a mental institution is because the way he asks questions and follows up questions and then tries to turn the answers into things that would make Jack think differently. So, like Jack would say, you know, I did this because it's artistic or whatever. And then Verge would reply, I can see the art in it, but wouldn't you think that if you had done it this way instead, you know, meaning, you know, if you picked up a painting instead of slaughtering people, you know, you could have been a different person or whatever. And so the questions and answers that go back and forth at points make it sound like, the good or bad devil, the bad devil and the good angel on each shoulder, or like I said, a psychiatric doctor trying to make a serial killer better or change their odd beliefs in what's right and wrong.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But so.
And I just want to mention briefly before we proceed to incident two, that something this summary kind of leaves out because it's one of the interruptions. That they use to interrupt these stories is that Jack is an architect.
No, that's right.
And has been trying to design his own house, but he started like several different times with several different plans and ended up bulldozing all of them because they weren't what he really wanted. And he's still trying to figure out what he wants.
Yeah, and it does lead up to a really weird visual at the
which we'll get to at the end.
But there is a it does go somewhere. This whole thing with the house does go somewhere.
It's important, which is why I decided to mention it since it's missing from these little snippets I'm going to be reading.
Right. Well, and a couple of things. One, obviously, it's very important because the name of the movie is The House That Jack Built. Right. Mm-hmm. So metaphorically or not, it's important.
But I think it's one thing that's very important to bring up is what comes back to what I mentioned about the surface thing is that this matter of the house can really get us feel kind of forgotten sometimes because there's so much more of the serial killer storyline going on.
Right. Yep.
Right. And also, being an architect is in some ways being an artist. For example, you know, so it makes sense because if he's comparing his serial killer work to art to and therefore to architecture, it kind of makes sense in that personality, assuming you are mentally insane to look at everything artistically, even if it's murder. So I thought that was interesting too. And another aspect of all that was, well, we'll get into it. I mean, there's a lot more to go. Where we want to go next?
Well, let's go to incident two.
Sure. Okay.
As it reads here, Jack knocks on the door of another woman and claims that he can help her with her dead husband's pension. The woman invites him in and he stabs her through the heart. His obsessions with trying to clean up every surface in the house nearly leads to his undoing as a suspicious cop comes by. He then ties the woman's body to the back of the car and drags her body all the way back to the industrial freezer. Around this time, Jack ends up giving himself the serial killer moniker, Mr. Sophistication.
All right. Yeah. Now, this one was a very odd story.
Dude, this was cracking me up, this one.
Yeah, this was the comic relief one.
Certainly. His entire stick of trying to pass himself as a cop and then a salesman and then talking those discussions with the police officer. Yeah, this was definitely the more lighthearted one. As lighthearted as it can be for this kind of subject matter. Mm-hmm. Especially after he finishes dragging the body all the way to the freaking freezer and there's barely anything left.
Well, and I gotta say, the way this scene wraps up is that he basically he interacts with the cop inside the house and he's moved the body of the woman outside. And he basically says something to him to make him stay inside the house while he goes outside and he ties her to the back of the truck. And just takes off, and all the way back to the freezer, like the road is eroding the front half of this woman's body. It's so disgusting, and it's just leaving a trail of blood and skin all the way back to where he stores all his dead bodies. And he gets there, and he realizes what's happening. He's like, "Oh fuck!" And then the sky opens up. And it starts pouring rain to wash away the blood trail.
Yeah, it's a great downpour, something he mentions. It just completely, just literally gets him scot-free.
Now, the thing that was great about this scene was it shows, even though it's comic relief kind of disorder and whatnot, there's a big aspect of this scene that shows the mental illness of Jack because of the OCD.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You know, because he thinks
also. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just gonna say he thinks he may have left his wallet or license, even though we all know he didn't. But it's just that thing that an OCD person has. That's an issue. He thinks that blood spots will be everywhere,
and keeps on picturing blood spots in places like behind the picture on the wall.
Yeah.
And when you stop and think about it, how the fuck would blood get behind the picture on the wall?
Yeah.
Right. It's just all OCD, everything related to it. And as a result, it shows you his mental state isn't just that of a sociopath, but it's also there's other things wrong that we could actually argue are probably the reason why he's a sociopath or just a murderer in general because he just has all these issues.
It becomes a double-edged sword for him because on one hand, it allows him to be very thorough and clean up his messes. On the other hand, it makes him keep going back to you even when the cops are showing up.
Right. Yeah, if he didn't have the OCD, he could have left, covered up the body with the body and not had a blood trail all the way back to his lair. But the OCD caused all the problems, mm-hmm. which is kind of funny. The OCD is there and making him think that he's solving the problems because he's going to clean up and he's going to do this and he's going to make sure, double check to make everything's okay. But it's actually the thing that almost gets him caught.
Right. Couple more things to mention. One is that I found it very interesting that when he's talking to the woman through her screen door, they show you how he's spinning his bullshit by looking at stuff in her house behind her. You know, he sees the grocery bag with the name of the grocery store on it and says something about that. And then he sees, I think it's a little memorial plaque that she has with a picture of her former husband on it. And that's when he comes up with this bullshit line about trying to increase the pension and gets into the house. Yeah. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. My actually favorite part of that whole scene was thinking there would be a blood spot underneath the stool leg.
Right.
It just doesn't make any sense. but yeah, that whole scene of him talking his way into the house, including like someone drives by and they wave and he waves and she says something like, "Oh, you know the Smiths too?" "Oh, yes, yes, I'm good friends with this man or something." Yeah.
right.
You know, and it was as good dialogue as you would see in like a Quentin Tarantino film without being cultish.
Mm-hmm.
It was like more of a like just normal people talking, a bullshitter and a woman that's suspicious, and it was just well done. Really, really awesome scene.
Right, and the other thing to mention is that while he's dragging the body around behind the van, they're playing the David Bowie song "Fame."
That's right.
Which is such a surreal conflict on what's going on. It's fucking hilarious. I was just cackling while that song was playing, and they show this poor woman's body just being shredded on the road behind this van. I couldn't stop laughing. And maybe that says something about me, but I think it was intentional on the filmmaker's part.
The actress is well known in the sense that you may not know her name, but I mean, she's been in so many, many things mm-hmm. that I immediately identify.
She's one of those people where you see her face and you're like, "Oh, her."
Yeah.
But exactly. You know her name. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And, a lot of characters in this, but that woman, I felt probably most sad for that woman.
Yeah.
Out of everybody. I mean, there's a lot of people that didn't deserve to die. There's no doubt about it, but she was like just, a random person knock on a door type of murder rather than other people who purpose or mistakenly put themselves in the situation.
Well, here's an interesting thing too about the, most of the victims in this film are women, but an interesting thing to keep in mind as well is that they don't have any names except for Simple.
Right.
And it really kind of adds a thing to the character Jack, who doesn't really try to connect to any of the victims or really understand them as people, but just targets.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So that really shows the kind of dimension there too. It does kind of make them one dimensional. They are one dimensional, but in a way that it makes sense from the point of view of the main character. I think that's where it can make sense for me from a storytelling perspective. It also, but at the same time, I think of it all the time. I just feel like in comparison to this act. Incident 4, I don't know. I felt these characters were, I don't know. I maybe the lack of connection was kind of ruined some of the punch in certain scenes.
But yeah, okay, I see what you're saying. Yeah, because Simple, we actually get to know a little more.
Yeah, and I think that's what kind of made it was shocking, because there's other characters that that Jack interacts with that he apparently had known for a while, but they're not very developed either.
Right. Yeah. No, that's a fair point. Yeah. Like this is, like I said, just a random person, and she actually could have survived had she not let him in the house, and fallen for his stick. But yeah, some of the other characters specifically simple. I see exactly what you're saying, Abe, because here's someone that trusted Jack, was good friends with Jack, was actually a, kind of a girlfriend of Jack. But we'll get into her when we get to incident four. So.
All right. Well, I guess on to incident three.
Well, what were the philosophy things that were discussed in this one? This one didn't do the street light yet, was it? I can't even remember. Was this the concentration camp one?
No, the concentration camp comes later after the street light.
Okay.
So I think this was the street light one.
Oh.
Okay. Yeah, that was an interesting thing. Basically, is actually animation to demonstrate what they're talking about. And basically, Jack talks about the feeling of being a killer. He says, when I haven't killed, it's like me being far away from a street lamp, you know, like in the middle of the night and you're walking down the street. And my shadow is the emptiness or something like that, that I feel, because as the further you're away from the light, it's that your shadow is thinner and thinner.
When the shadow in front of him starts to grow, you know, that's in a state where he feels his euphoria of his killing. While behind him is another shadow, kind of showing kind of the emptiness of it. And as it kind of stretches out and shrinks back, it kind of leads to a point where he says he has to kill again to repeat that cycle.
Yeah, so basically, the shadow is very thin because he's far away from the light. And so it's like you said, the sadness or emptiness. And then after he does the killing, it's like walking right towards the light and under the light when your shadow is as dark as black.
Really hard to describe. And the animation helps a lot.
Yeah, exactly. And then when you keep past the light and you're fading away from the light, your shadow begins to stretch again and become thin. And that's when the emptiness happens again, and so he has to repeat and kill again.
But Verge makes a good point, too, that that could be attributed to other kind of addictions like alcoholism.
Yeah, well, the thing is, he definitely has, like, the OCD alone makes me consider that, you know, this is his addiction to murder or need to get the high from murdering.
There's also a moment where he actually runs over a person at random because he felt this compulsion, he had to do it.
Right, exactly.
Right, yeah. And I think at the end of this segment, when he gives himself the name Mr. Sophistication, this is also the scene where we see him practicing emotion in the mirror, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah,
And he's got a bunch of pictures of people out of magazines. He got he clips them out and pastes them by a mirror, so he can look at the picture and try and imitate the facial expression in the mirror, so he can try and act like he's having the same emotions that a normal person would.
Mm-hmm. Right, and as people who know, and for Dan, your buddy Dan probably would because of psychology and all that. When you have a dissocial or antisocial personality disorder, or otherwise known as psychopath or sociopath, your emotions aren't the same as regular people. Basically, you don't feel empathy or anger or happiness the same way, you know, 5% of the population does. The 5% that have this problem don't have the same feelings that we do, so they have to mimic or lie to get others to believe, and that's why they're wired differently. So it's impossible to cure, I guess they say. But so when people and it's hard to diagnose because a lot of times they just lie. Because they want you to, answer questions the way they think you want them to be answered, rather than answering how they actually think.
Yeah, basically, it's the chameleon practicing to change its colors.
Yeah, that's a good analogy, and this here, Eric, was a perfect scene to bring up because it shows Jack trying to mimic these emotions that he really doesn't have, because he's not why the same as us. All right. So anything else about the mirror scene or incident two, I guess it's called?
That's all I had.
Yeah. Same here. Okay.
All right. Let's move on to incident number three. Jack takes a woman he is dating and her two sons, Grumpy and George, out for a hunting lesson. Shortly after, he kills both sons using a sniper rifle at a distance and forces the woman to feed pie to George. He eventually ends up killing the woman, then rearranges Grumpy's face into a grotesque smile.
Yeah, this is where kind of we kind of see an escalation of,
right.
of stuff. I mean, this is like, I mean, the woman, I mean, the first incident, you know, the woman was a bitch, and, you know, and the second one was the killing was kind of not as bloody until he dragged the body. This is where it takes a complete, goes up, takes a complete, like, 10 levels up.
Well, there. Because he kills two children as well.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Well, not to mention he won't make the mother feed the dying one pie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
that was kind of brutal. Like, some ways he's making this woman feed pie to her dead son. It's like, oh.
Yeah. At this point, she's already like
catatonic.
Yeah. I actually didn't get that she was someone he was dating.
Oh yeah.
Okay, so I missed that. I don't know how I missed that. That's kind of bizarre. But I guess the difference between her and Simple is we don't really learn as much about her as we do Simple, and we'll talk.
Oh, we don't learn about anything other than this woman aside from her son.
No.
Yeah.
But there is this interesting thing, and I'm trying to remember if this was added to the director's cut or not. And Phil, since you watched the theatrical version,
yeah.
But did he describe the method of hunting the deer family and what order it should be done in?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
And he did in the director's cut as well. So that's. Yeah.
Right. What was added to the director's cut, at least I'm pretty certain, is that when he decides to rearrange Grumpy, I'm pretty sure there were several quick but close-up and gruesome shots of him like getting all the wire into the skin to make it stay in place. So yeah, that was pretty brutal.
It was a brutal scene. It was, it's one of those big button pusher scenes.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, I mean, we don't get hinted at what happens. We see each of these things take place.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know? Yeah. I mean, the first two killings are more thriller or slasher type killings. This one was most certainly one that I could see audience members freaking out and saying, okay, I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
Because not only does he two children get killed, but then he uses the body, you know, he tries to make the body, fiddles with the body basically to mm-hmm. have the grin continuously because, you know, and whatnot. And it's not just a body of a person, it's a child too. So it's,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the killing is much more sadistic in this one, in that you know, he pretty much hunts them down.
Right.
I mean, again, it's not as necessarily as bloody as the other killings, but it's definitely more terrifying and psychological for sure. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because they know what's going on.
Yeah.
and I think this actress who played the woman in this scene, what was her name, Phil?
The actress, is that Sophie Grovall?
Yeah. She was very good. I'd never heard of her before this.
She's from his homeland, Denmark. That's why we probably never seen her.
The way she played shock in this incident was really quite convincing.
Yeah, she does a lot of Danish television. But she does English language stuff as well. But most of her credits are Danish from Denmark. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So she's pretty big over there. She was excellent. I mean, everybody was excellent in this film. The acting was splendid all around. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And her role was fairly small, and it wasn't.
It was very small, but
not
good.
Much speaking either. Not much speaking either, right? She just had to be in a catatonic state, and I felt that was the interesting thing about her. The whole scene was the catatonic state of her compared to how they could have played it, where she could have been freaking out and screaming,
right,
or something, you know. And no, she was like, the moment her child died or children died, she was like done as
yeah, she checked out.
Yeah, she checked out. Yeah.
Her entire spirit was broken at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So what was
I'm pretty sure that this is the scene that most people had major issues with, because it's violence against children. And B, it's using a gun, which is a sensitive topic for some people at this point. So that's the, I believe that this scene is the reason that this movie got some of the shit that it did.
Yeah, there was also another scene. I think it got some serious shit was the duckling scene.
Oh, that's not even in the description. When did that happen?
That actually was did get a lot of crap from internet bloggers and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, I blocked it out.
I actually even text. I watched the film like the day after you watched it, Eric, when it first came out, and I texted you. I go, I hope that was a CGI duck.
Yeah,
I don't know if you remember me texting you that.
Well, it's actually from the trivia here about that. So it reads as following. This is actually an X-ray of the Amazon Video copy. It goes, the scene involving the main character's mutilation of a duckling when he was a child was done with the help of special effects, and the duckling was not harmed.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I believe it, because he doesn't seem like the person that would be that stupid. And also, I'm sure at the end of the movie, if we went through the credits, it would say, no animals were harmed in this film.
Yeah. You know, that would really burn extra bridges if he had done that. But it continues saying, despite this, there was considerable audience backlash toward the scene. But PETA had defended the film in a statement praising its accurate portrayal of the link between adolescent animal abuse and psychopathy. Mm-hmm. Animal cruelty is actually known to be a common trait among serial killers, especially when they're young.
Yeah.
It's one of the, what do they call it? The warning triad?
Sign. Yeah, it is the triad. One is fires. The other
bedwetting.
Is bedwetting and killing animals.
Yeah. It's one of the earlier warning signs that someone's seriously fucked up in that person's head.
Yeah. Yeah, when you don't have any empathy and you're killing animals, that's a definite sure sign.
Warning. Warning.
Yeah.
Danger, Will Whopper saying. Danger.
Yeah.
All right. We have anything else to say about the hunting
scene?
Oh,
yeah. What was the philosophy lesson on now this one?
I can't don't remember. Recall.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
something. I can't remember if it was this one or the next incident where they do the thing about the, because the duckling one was the same one where they did the fields.
Oh, the scythe. Yeah.
The scythe. Yeah, and they had some shots of men using old fashioned scythes to mow a field, and they're hypnotic. I actually really enjoyed those scenes. There's a very distinct sound of them all in sync.
Yeah.
Swinging the scythes and cutting the grass.
So you mean like the Grim Reaper weapon?
Yes. That's, yeah.
And
yeah.
How do you pronounce that word?
Scythe.
Scythe, okay. Yeah, because it was one of those words that, you know, I saw hundreds of times in Dungeons & Dragons and books, but right. I never actually heard it spoken out loud ever. Until maybe one time earlier that you and Mike were talking about it, and then now. So I've never really heard the word spoken. That's kind of interesting.
Well, now you have. It's a scythe.
Okay.
Scythe.
Some people pronounce the C, but I don't think you're supposed to.
Right. Yeah, so they have all those farmers cutting the wheat or
right.
whatever.
Yeah. Harvesting. I don't know if they're harvesting or mowing, but they're cutting what's ever there. I also found it really interesting that the guys that were doing that, I mean, I'm pretty sure that wasn't CGI, but like the guys that were doing that were good enough at it. They were like keeping what they were cutting at the same level with each swing. Right. I was like, that's gotta be difficult swinging something that weighs that much back and forth and keeping it at the same level.
Right.
But yeah. I thought that was actually one of the more beautiful things in the movie, particularly a shot towards the end of the movie, where they put some visual effects on it, of the guys swinging the saws. I love that.
Right. Yeah. All right. So anything else about this hunting scene? I will state that, the movie, I did some research. They may have said it in the film, but I forgot because, you know, it's not really that important where it takes place. But it's supposed to be Washington State. And and so I felt that that was interesting because even though Washington State has a very much rural section, especially the eastern part of the state, it is a state that is known to be very liberal. Mm-hmm. So guns aren't necessarily something that everybody would necessarily have there. But again, it may be similar to Vermont. Vermont's another very progressive state, and everybody has guns there. So,
well, and I think anywhere there's a good amount of wilderness, you're going to have hunters at least.
Yeah, exactly. And this was most certainly a hunter's gun, a rifle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the whole thing. I mean, they had targets there, and like in other words, the targets were looked like deers and things like that. So you're right. This was most certainly a rural section, and for hunters. And obviously, the woman and her children were apt to be into that, right? Because they were out there to learn hunting. So
right.
Yeah.
Well, they learned hunting.
Yeah, human hunting. Human. It was just crazy.
Hunting, we will go. For hunting, we will go.
All right. Anything else on the hunting segment?
I think we're good. Yeah.
All right. Let's go on to incident number four.
One little thing.
Well, okay.
How unlucky must you be as a kid to be named Grumpy by your own mother?
I don't think his name was actually Grumpy.
Right.
I think that's what Jack named him in his head.
Oh well, it's still. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that was what he was naming them, or you know, not the kid's real name.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the other kid wasn't named George either.
Right. Probably not.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just pretty funny though.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Onward.
All right. Incident four. Abe's favorite. Jack meets Jacqueline, a woman that he calls Simple, as he believes her to be stupid. Jack confesses he has killed 60 people at this point and is the serial killer Mr. Sophistication, but Jacqueline does not believe him. After he proceeds making red circles around her breasts with a marker, she tries to get away and tell a cop, but he dismisses her as drunk. Eventually, Jacqueline fails to escape, and Jack cuts off her breasts with a knife and murders her. He pins one of the breasts to the police car and fashions the other one into a wallet.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I think this scene obviously would have been a problem scene too for a lot of folk. Because of the specific violence, not necessarily because it was a woman, but because it was a part of the body that is only specific to women that
right.
It was an act of sexual violence.
Well, and this is another scene where I'm pretty sure they added like a second and a half in the director's cut when he actually goes through with cutting off her breasts. In the theatrical version, I don't think you see the cut actually happen, whereas in the director's cut, you do. They do show him, put the breast on the cut off breast on the windshield in both versions, but I don't think you see the actual act of the cut in the theatrical, whereas you do in the director's cut.
Okay, how about that? Yeah, it makes sense that if they were going to cut something for a theatrical release, that would be the thing to do.
Right.
Now the woman, Simple or Jacqueline, is the actress Riley Q. So this is one of the films that she's been recently starring in. Under the Silver Lake is another one that she's actually in now. She was also in Mad Max that came out a couple of years ago.
She one of the sirens?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. She was one of the sirens. And she's also Elvis Presley's granddaughter as well.
Oh, no shit. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, this scene was I can see why Abe was horrified, and not necessarily because of the mutilation of the breast, but the psychological terror of someone who trusts somebody and actually loves somebody, and then finds out that no friggin' way. Yeah. You're the person that is in the newspapers murdering everybody, well, and I'm now your next victim.
There's another thing that, about it that was very heavy, too, is how he just continued to belittle her throughout the entire segment. You know, the mental mental attack, mm-hmm. the verbal abuse and everything like that mm-hmm. was, in my opinion, much more gut-wrenching than any of the violence scenes, because it was just breaking this poor girl down. And, I sympathize with Simple a lot because we learned a little more about her, which made this, you know, much more tragic and more shocking, even though in comparison to the other deaths that take place.
And I think that this segment actually had the most horrifying moment for me in that after he reveals to her that he's a killer, he has her trapped in the apartment. And she goes to scream, and he's like, yeah, go ahead, scream. And she starts screaming, and he starts screaming with her, calling for help. And he's like, yeah, you want to try the window? Go ahead. And she starts screaming out the window, and he's like, yeah, nobody's coming. Nobody cares. And it's just like, fuck.
Yeah, and but
which just leads me back to my point that people suck.
Other people suck, but I think it also touches on a kind of societal thing about the apathy and almost numbness of society.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, oh, no doubt about it. Also, it's an interesting characterization of Jack, because these last two instances are fairly different from the first two instances, because mm-hmm. the first two incidences were random and the point was to just kill them and be done with it, while the last two, incident 3 and 4, we find out that it's not just the killing that entertains him, but the psychological torture of the people as he's killing them.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it's a difference between a hitman that goes up to the victim and just shoots him in the head, or someone like Son of Sam, who used to randomly just go up to cars and shoot people in the head and then run,
mm-hmm.
versus, say, someone who, like,
gets off on the torture aspect.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
They enjoy with the process of breaking someone down.
Exactly.
And I also enjoyed in this segment the fact that at one point she gets out and approaches the cop and tells her that this guy is Mr. Sophistication and has killed 60 people. And he just starts acting drunk and is like, yeah, that's right, I am. I killed them all. And right. he's just like, you two get the fuck back in your apartment and stop drinking.
Which, unfortunately, is very sad, because, like, for example, Jeffrey Dahmer, uh-huh. there was a couple of times when they could have caught him, and they just thought it was gay lovers that were fighting.
Right, right.
You know, and then the cops just blew him off, and they actually brought back one of the victims to Dahmer's house
uh-huh.
because he couldn't speak English, because he was, Indo-Chinese. And as a result, that poor person, you know,
ended up in the freezer.
Yeah, exactly. And here it's similar to that, where the cops just thinks it's a couple of drunks yeah. acting like it.
Yeah. Police incompetence is another thing that is shown throughout the film as well.
That's actually true. Yeah, because yep. Incident 2 demonstrates police incompetence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the cop knew there was something fishy, and yet, you know, didn't get any real information on Jack, and of course Jack got away. So, mm-hmm. yeah. So you're absolutely right, Abe. That's a good point.
Well, and because of that scene where the cop just tells him to get the hell out of there, I maybe I'm a bad person, but I laughed out loud when he ran back and put her cut off breast underneath his windshield wiper like a parking ticket. I thought that was really funny. Because that cop is going to know where that came from.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, actually, I didn't understand why Jack did that. But now that you bring it up, Eric, I do understand. It was purposely to show the cop that, you know, you fucked up.
Yeah, you had the mystification in front of you and you let him go.
Yeah, because your incompetence or laziness or whatever. Because, you know, he could have just talked to them a little longer.
Uh-huh.
To make sure that it was actually just drunks,
uh-huh.
but he didn't. He was lazy.
And this scene is also one of the scene where he has a crutch, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And he's talking about, like, this is actually something that I think Ted Bundy used to do.
That's true.
Yes, because he would go.
Or
it's also in Silence of the Lambs. Yeah. Well, and I think Silence of the Lambs got it from Bundy.
Well,
yeah. Which is making yourself look weaker than you are by having a crutch. So that people want to help you and then doing bad things to them.
But there's another thing, too, that this took place in the 1970s, I believe.
It was a 12-year period, so it could have overlapped. It was over a decade, so I'm not sure what years, but it doesn't surprise me that it would be closer to that time frame than our time frame, because there's no real cell phones or anything in the film.
Because it seems like a lot of technology hasn't really advanced a whole lot. And the police, resources and technology seems very low level that they can't really pick up on any kind of forensic evidence.
And the cop cars are pretty old fashioned.
Yeah.
That's a good point about the forensic evidence, right? No DNA.
It makes sense, too, because the 1970s was when the period where there was a lot of rise in serial killings. And a lot of the most infamous figures appeared.
Yeah, no, that's true. What's that, Eric?
I said Mindhunter.
Yeah, there you go.
I can't wait till season two of that. Anyway, back to this movie.
Whenever that's coming out.
So, Abe, you really love this segment. Anything else you want to talk about here?
Well, I just thought this was just a lot more, because we had a clear idea of this kind of screwed up relationship and just kind of seeing how it played out until it's at the most horrific last moment of it was just a very powerful and very unsettling scene. I don't know. It just really worked. Honestly, this had been just one entire horrifying story of this kind of relationship here. I would have liked that as well if it was just that, because it was just that strong and that unsettling, you know.
Yeah, well, Abe, I see what you're saying, because we learn a lot about Simple, or Jacqueline, I should say. And the thing about her is, she has trust in her. I mean, if we want to look at this as a more worldly thing and not two individuals, you can say that here's a person that trusts somebody with everything, because they're friends, they're lovers, they're companions, they've had fun together, whatever. And then literally, the rug's pulled out under you. And we've seen this in so many real life things, from domestic abuse where, you know, they get married and then the woman gets beaten up, or children being abused. And they're, you know, they love their caretaker, and yet their caretaker is the one that's harming them or hurting them. And this is like a vignette of real world situations, to the point of, like you said, to the worst outcome it could ever be, which is not only you find out the person that you're supposed to love or is supposed to be good to you is evil, but it's the impersonation of evil, which is the serial killer, and you didn't even know, because that person was able to cover up all of it.
Yeah.
Because of their sociopathic, they can lie, you know?
Yeah. It's also just how the helplessness of the situation, too. You know, as Eric brought up, the hotel that was being locked in that room was pretty gut-wrenching. You know, that entire
for
help and everything like that. That, you know, I just thought this was a very strong scene. It was stomach-churning. It was really hard to watch, but it was well done.
Well, and that's the thing. It's like, if you're, you know, you're a person, you can go wherever you want or whatever, and then suddenly you're confined and there's nothing you can do about it. And you know where this is going to lead. And then to find out that no one's coming to help when you're given every opportunity to get help, whether it's screaming out the window where people should hear, or whether you run up to a cop who's supposed to help you, and then you find out it doesn't matter. And as you said, Eric, what Jack said, which is nobody cares.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just horrific.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely terrible.
And it's true.
What was the philosophy lesson that Verge and Jack talked about here?
I don't know if it was in the middle of this, but I think at the end of this segment is when they go on the extended thing with the concentration camp and all that.
And the,
before we get to Incident 5.
Okay, and you saw the extended version. What's going on with this? Explain this scene.
I can't.
It's a weird scene. Basically, at certain point, you're talking about the magnificent construction of some of the war machines and death camps created by some of those evil figures. One of them was one of the, I think it was a German warplane. And that's the sound it made as it dove.
Right, that was awesome. To know that was the sound that we hear, the vzzz, was intentional
on purpose.
You know, and things like that. It was, but I'm not sure, you know, I didn't see the actual cut, so I'm not sure how much was added to that.
Right. Yeah, well, basically what they're talking about is a lot of things like how man and the beauty in art can also be used for things that are horrendous mm-hmm. and that will kill. And so
there was a quick clip from Antichrist in that segment.
Yes, I saw that. Yeah, I mean, I didn't see the movie, but I knew it was from Antichrist.
I think he used a number of clips from some of his movies.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're right. That's the one I identified immediately on my first watch, though.
Yeah, yeah. And so basically, like, he's explaining, like, the Luftwaffe plane, which basically means the German Air Force, was made not only to kill, but it was also made to scare or cause
terrify.
Terrify. And that's why the genius scientists or engineers built the plane. They added something that made that whistle sound or the screeching sound when it came down to, you know, bomb or fighter shoot its missiles or whatever it did. And people would freak because they know, oh my God, we're in trouble. So I think the Jack and Verge are basically trying to discuss that even though art is brilliant, it's also can be used wrong, maybe? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard to explain, except that, kind of not. It's almost an analogy of what he's doing, because he keeps on saying that I'm doing art. My murders are an art. And then
Verge is calling bullshit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he's going, so, with the, you know, because the screeching planes and the bombs and all that are technically brilliant art, too, because anytime you build anything, whether it's writing computer programming or a skyscraper, building a skyscraper or a plane that bombs and kills people, it's technically something brilliant that is being done because it's creating something. And yet sometimes you're creating something for the wrong purposes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We want to say anything else about that?
Abe?
Not me.
Okay, let's move on.
All right. So we get to incident number 5. Jack has detained 5 people and tied them to a makeshift post, lining their heads up in a row with the intention of killing them all with one bullet, but realizes that the bullet is not a full metal jacket bullet. He kills a man known as SP and a cop, then grabs the one bullet he needs and steals the police car, which he leaves outside his freezer space with the siren blazing. After arriving, for the first time, he manages to open the door behind the freezer and sees Verge. Verge suggests that Jack has unfinished business and has never really built the house that he was intending to build. Using the bodies as material, Jack constructs a house out of them, and when he enters the makeshift house, he sees a hole that leads down. At this point, cop successfully torches the door, and Jack decides to go through the hole, following Verge.
There you go.
Now, this scene was very confusing to me. The part with lining them up and wanting to shoot him with one bullet, okay, fine. But then, as soon as he opens that door, things get weird.
Yeah. It pretty much goes into surrealism and kind of a low-key fantasy element.
Well, and here's what I don't understand, and maybe one or both of you understood it better than I did, is that for this whole movie, he's talking to Verge, and given that in this next part we're about to go into, they repeat some of the dialogue that we hear at the beginning of the movie, we're led to believe that this whole time he's been relating this story while Verge is taking him to hell, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But while he's relating this story of tying the guys to the post and doing this and opening all that door, Verge is in the story. So how can Verge be in the story that he's telling to Verge?
I think we don't see his death from the cops.
Uh huh.
And this is similar to like, Jacob's Ladder or some film like that where he's already dead and he doesn't know it yet.
Maybe. Okay. I can accept that. Because in this, the way it's told here is that Verge gives him the idea of building a house out of those bodies. So A, did that act actually occur in real life? And B, did Verge actually suggest it to him, or is it Jack just being fucking nuts?
Yeah, It seemed like quite the process to put all those bodies together to create that structure.
Uh-huh.
Right. Yeah, that took a lot of time, and the cops were already starting to come after him at that point. So I think at some point, as soon as he opened the door, he actually was shot.
Okay.
Right. That's
so
what
you don't
I
think that structure was ever built?
Well, maybe symbolically, because there's no way he had the time to put it together before he got killed.
Okay.
Yeah, so it was that. I think it's what Abe just said. However, if you want to look at it as if he did create it, we could then say that Verge becoming corporal was him beginning to crack because of the stress of the cops coming and all that, and he knows he's caught, and him having a mental... Mm-hmm. A behavioral health, mentally insane vision before he finally dies.
Okay.
And well, so this is another weird thing, too, is that Verge, has been with, has been apparently in a lot of the photos that Jack's been taking of his victims.
Well, is that a truth, though, or is that a vision?
Well, that's a weird thing, too, because I kept wondering, like, wait a minute. That's like, I was asking myself the question because I was wondering if Jack if he's being watched by Verge the entire time. If that was the case, then why would Verge not know about the killings? And that's where it got a little weird.
Yeah, okay.
Right, right. Or is it, like you said, just a vision, or is he just imagining it, or is Verge a ghost, or, you know, and is just there all the time, or whatnot? I mean, that's a good question. But before we let's take each step of this scene, because this is obviously a very long incident, because it's from the killing to getting the bullet and then to the afterworld. First off, this is the first scene where we see him murdering non-woman. In other words,
they're all men.
They're all men. So this is where he becomes non-prejudiced against the gender of who he's going to kill. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing. Second thing is, for folks who don't know what a Full Metal Jacket ammo is, I had to go look it up, because I always used to think Full Metal Jacket meant something to do with the military uniform that you use. But it's actually a bullet that is usually lead that's encased around with another metal, such as copper or something. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, I didn't bother reading further into it. These type of bullets are the ones that are, I guess, the most powerful compared to a regular bullet, even though you're using the same gun.
Well, yeah, and that's because the outer casing of the full metal jacket is a harder metal, whereas lead tends to spread upon impact and stop the progress of the bullet in the process of being misshapen. The full metal jacket retains its shape and tends to go through whoever is shooting.
Right. There was a I guess also there was a one of those Hague conventions before the UN or the League of Nations. So back in 1899, they were trying to make an international treaty to not use these type of ammunition. Mm-hmm. And a number of countries, including the United States, didn't sign that convention, which would have outlawed these type of weapons. And to be honest, that was probably
it sounds weird. It's not a weapon, it's a type of ammo.
You're absolutely right. I'm sorry, this type of ammo. And it sounds weird or heartless, but when World War I came and World War II, but specifically World War I, when mustard gas was being used and landmines and all this other stuff, no one was following any of the conventions anyway.
Right.
And so the point with trench warfare and all that was going on, they were just everybody, if you didn't use what your enemy was using, you were going to lose. So you had to use what your enemy was using.
Yeah, pretty much using, going by whatever means necessary to get the upper hand.
Well, I also am not entirely sure I agree that using a full metal jacket bullet would be worse. I mean, it's more effective.
Yeah.
But I mean, this might sound cold, but in some cases, wouldn't that be good? Wouldn't you want to be killed on the first shot rather than sitting around and suffering for a while?
That's a fair point too. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it was more about, how many people you could kill with one bullet. Rather than how quickly it could kill someone. It was basically how many more casualties can inflict on the enemy.
Yeah, well, and I'm reading here is that when this Hague Convention came into effect, what happens is these full metal jacket bullets basically expand and explode when they hit the target.
Oh, did I have it backwards?
No, not necessarily, because if it expands and explodes, it's going to cause a bigger hole or go right through your head.
I thought penetrating was the advantage that it had, and I guess I was wrong about that.
That's what Jack was intending with this bullet, because he was trying to kill five people with one bullet.
Yeah, well, right. And that's the thing, is that the reason the treaty was supposed to go into effect was because it's supposed to stop suffering of soldiers from expanding and exploding ammunition. Mm. But you have a good point there, Eric, which is, and demonstrated in this film, is that an expanding and exploding bullet will kill you immediately versus one that doesn't, and then you just sit there in no man's land, between the trenches, where you're just in agony and pain, suffering until you bleed out.
Well, at the same time, that seems contradictory to what they were talking about in this incident, because one of the guys he ties up to shoot is former military and identifies his bullet as not being a full metal jacket bullet. But Jack seems to think that he needs a full metal jacket bullet to get through all five guys' skulls. And it seems to me like an expanding and an exploding bullet would have less of a chance of getting through the skulls.
Yeah. Let me see. Let me read the impact characteristics based off of what it says here. It says, by design, fully jacketed projectiles have less capacity to expand after contact.
Okay.
Okay, that's interesting. With the target than a hollow point projectile. While this can be an advantage when engaging targets behind cover, it can also be a disadvantage, as a full metal jacket bullet may pierce completely through a target, leading to less severe wounding and possibly failing to disable the target. Interesting.
Gotcha.
Furthermore, a projectile that goes completely through a target can cause unintentional collateral damage downrange of the target.
Got it. Okay, so I did understand.
Yes. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yay me.
And yet the Hague Convention, the Hague Convention makes it sound as if it explodes.
That's weird.
Honestly, I thought that was a hollow point that did that.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, that, well, that's, yeah, we'll see what a hollow point is, expanding mode. Okay, okay. So then maybe I just read it wrong. So let me read this again. So why would the Hague Convention want to ban them? The primary use of the jacketed ammunition comes from the Hague Convention. The United States didn't sign this convention, which, among other things, outlawed the use of bullets which expand or flatten easily in the human body. Okay, okay. So
those are two different things that were in the same proposal.
Yes, right.
Got
exactly.
It.
There you go. So. Yeah,
we got it all figured out.
Yeah. Anyway, we can move on from the political stuff or the treaty stuff. Okay, so yeah, so if he gets this bullet, then it won't explode or get stuck in the first person's head.
And it'll go through all of them. Or he wants to see if it will.
Yeah, yeah, because he's insane.
Yes.
And these people know, and they all know they're going to die too, which is the most horrible thing about it. Yeah, and then he has this interesting thing where he's going to find the bullet. And the thing about Jack, which is odd because he seems like a smart guy and he's educated, college and all that, but he's very sloppy because of...
Well, and part of and it's interesting in the incidents that are told, a lot of the reason he's so successful is just blind luck. Yeah. Like the rainstorm.
Yeah. Or how stupid the cop was with the
right.
Yeah.
But exactly. At this point in the story, the local cops have started to catch on. I wasn't clear on the methodology they used, but they somehow tracked him back to where he buys the ammo. And in between when he purchased the bullet that he thought was Full Metal that wasn't, and when he goes back to get an actual Full Metal jacket, the shop owner has been informed by the cops that this guy's a killer and he really shouldn't sell him any more ammo. And if he comes back in, to contact the police.
See, that's where I was confused. I didn't understand why the guy was so suspicious of Jack, meaning the bullet salesman. But now that explains everything. He had already been warned that someone is looking for this type of weapon.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I think it was from the wife and the two kids that were shot.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I think somehow since they don't tell us what time this was in, I don't know if they did if they had the whole damn it. There's a term that I'm forgetting right now. It's when you figure out what gun a bullet came from.
Ballistics.
Thank you. I think they figured out from the ballistics on the mother and the children. They tracked it back to Jack's gun, I believe. They don't state it explicitly.
Right, right. Yeah, they didn't. And I didn't. That's why I was confused. But now that explains everything. And I can understand why the guy that was selling bullets immediately started acting odd and suspicious.
Right.
Because I couldn't figure that out, and I still hadn't until you brought it up, Eric. So this is good we're talking about this film.
Yeah. So after he's rejected at the actual store, he goes to a friend's – it was a trailer, right?
Yeah.
He goes to the trailer where a friend of his lives to try and see if he has any Full Metal jacket bullets. And his friend has also been contacted by the police. And his friend basically pulls a gun on him and says, sit down, we're waiting for the cops.
Yeah, and see, this is where I got confused again, too, because I was wondering why his friend betrayed him. And now everything's fallen into place.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what was weird, though, he was talking about, the friend found out it was about a robbery, not about a killing.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, explain that, Abe.
Yeah, I don't know. That's so confusing because the gun store owner found out that it was about the murders, but there was something about a robbery that had taken place that apparently Jack was involved in that got traced back to him that his friend found out about. I don't know. That was the one I was really scratching my head about. I don't know. I don't know if I missed something.
Right. No. You got it generally right. I would have to rewatch it once more to really get it ingrained what actually happened. But you're right. The guy had been tipped off that Jack had done something.
Mm-hmm.
And even though he was friends with Jack, that friendship was over because of something that Jack had done that he found out about. I don't even know if it was the gun shop guy that may have called him. I don't even know.
Maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. So the Jack kills this guy, and gets the bullet. But we know at this point he's all done.
Well, and I kind of like how he got the cop too, which is that he switched clothes with his friend. And left his friend on the floor and was standing up in his friend's clothes and was able to whip around and shoot the cop before he knew what was going on.
Right, exactly. Yeah. All right, so let's talk about the aftermath before the death sequence, the Dante sequence.
Okay.
Yeah, go on.
Well, basically, this is he takes the cop's car and goes back to the freezer. And during this last part, they kept on cutting back to the car just sitting there with its sirens going. And I don't know why, but it made me laugh. But he's trying to do his bullet thing in the freezer. But with the back wall of the freezer with a door in it, he can't get far enough away to focus the scope on the gun. So he finally succeeds in opening that door for the first time and getting far enough away that he can focus the scope. And that's when Verge shows up. And did we ever see him finally finish his little gun project?
No, I think it got.
I didn't think so.
No.
So as far as we know, he never actually shot those guys. Or we never saw that happen.
No, because we cut back to the door being cut open by the cops. We still see people struggling to get free.
Okay.
So maybe
those guys got saved.
Yeah. Maybe Jack got shot at that point before he actually got a chance to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, I mean, based off of this whole sequence, this Incident 5, a lot of it seems a little more vague, and us, the audience, have to figure it out. For example, how did the gun shop owner know? Why did his friend suddenly know? And why is Verge now corporal? Because, you know, is Jack dead or not?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it makes sense that it's a little more confusing, or a little more where we have to do the thinking because the next 20 minutes of the film is all that anyway, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's all the surreal stuff. So, so he builds the House of Humans. And I guess
the house that Jack built.
Yeah. So even though he's been trying to build a house through various vignettes between the incidences, we see him trying to build the house. He actually creates this house, and do we think that this house, whether it's in his figmentation of his imagination or he actually does it before he actually dies, I guess.
I'm with Abe that he didn't really have enough time.
Yeah.
So it's probably in his head.
No, that means
but goddamn, is that a striking image?
It's a hell of an image, and I think it comes back to his continuous attempt to try to build this house because. As we said earlier, one of the things that we cut in between not just the murders and the philosophical discussions, but it's little moments about him still struggling to figure out how to build his house, how many times he's torn it down, and how he can't get it right. And I think this is more of a symbolic, climax of that little thing.
Yeah, makes sense. I'm with you. All right, so let's talk about, I guess,
the journey.
how it transitions from what appears to be the real world in the freezer to the journey.
Well, basically, Jack goes through the hole in the floor, which is really a metaphor. And then at the end of the description in Wikipedia here, it says, an allusion to Dante's Inferno, Verge is actually the poet Virgil and is guiding Jack through hell. At the very bottom of hell, there is a bridge and a vast dark space below. The door on the other side of the bridge leads out of hell and presumably to heaven, as Verge tells Jack. The bridge is completely broken, but Jack notices that one could climb around the cliff and over to the other side. Although Verge tells him that he recommends against it, and this is not where he is to deliver him. Jack ignores him and tries to climb over, but falls down into the fiery abyss.
Now, where was Verge trying to take Jack? Was he trying to take him to one of the levels of hell? Or do you think somewhere else, like limbo or purgatory?
I think he was trying to take him to one of the levels of hell.
Yeah.
I personally think that he does this with everybody. Like, he brings everybody to this bridge and says, that's the really, 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 really bad hell down there. That's not where I'm supposed to take you. I'm supposed to take you to a not quite as bad hell. But I thought you'd want to see this. And everybody sees that, well, maybe they can escape, and tries it and ends up in a really, really, really bad hell.
Oh, yeah. I think he was just screwing with Jack at the end. You know, right. I think it was all just a trick at the end. Just to get him into that abyss. Or you know, if he was taken to anywhere else, maybe it was another circle where it was endless bingo night or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, there was no redemption arc at all, or anything. Obviously, Jack has done some horrible, horrible things, and even though he talked intellectually about his killings and the art and all that. And we could see that maybe he's just mentally unfit as a human being, and whether or not, in other words, when you have behavioral health issues, does that in any way forgive you for doing the horrible things that you do?
Nope.
Nope. Absolutely not.
And that's what I think this movie is trying to say, because had that been the case, we would have had a redemption arc either before he died or in the afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have that.
Also the fact that he consciously knew every choice he was making. He was not prepared.
Right.
You know, he honestly thought he was much better than everybody else. He could decide between, you know, what to do and what not to do. And he chose to kill.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the thing with sociopaths, right? They know what they're doing is wrong, and that's why there's two definitions of behavioral health. There's the medical definition and the legal definition. The medical definition is obviously sociopath is a type of mental illness, but the legal definition is if you know what you're doing is wrong, even if you don't have empathy, then you're guilty as charged because and aren't considered mentally ill under the law. So, for example, someone that's schizophrenic would be considered mentally ill both medically and judicially, but a sociopath would not be because they actually know that what they're doing is wrong, even if they don't care. Now, Eric, you were going to say something before?
Yeah, I didn't find the plot aspects of the journey to hell nearly as interesting as the visuals along the way. And I thought this was some of the most gorgeous stuff in the movie.
It was a very strange scenery. As I said, it had a very different feel from the rest of the movie.
Mm-hmm. And there's that one scene where Jack's looking out the window, and there's that shot I was talking about earlier with the men in the field using the saws. But it's like, they put effects on it so it looks almost like a motion painting, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And it's just gorgeous. And then they do that again with an image of them on a boat crossing a river. And then there's an image of the two of them on ladders. And then we get the wonderful lava fall at the entrance to hell. And all of it was just really, really gorgeous.
Yeah, it was pretty gorgeous. Now, but again, I think, like as Abe mentioned, this was an issue for him because it's different tone and it changes the movie from realism to, I guess, magical realism. And as a result, for some people, not Dan,
I would call it straight up surrealism.
Yeah.
Well, I have a problem between, you know, shifting from one kind of thing to another. It's mostly just that the feel of this, the sequence is so much different. It's very, very different in its approach and how it's shot and how it tries to tell a story versus the the narrative and dialogue between.
And this might be an acquired taste thing, Abe, because I don't know if you have you watched any other Von Trier movies?
This is my first one.
Okay. He does this a lot. And like I can remember it in both Antichrist and Melancholia. Like in Melancholia, there's some stunning visuals.
Oh yeah,
they're absolutely gorgeous that are very surreal. And then he'll go back to an actual plot with the characters. He switches back and forth frequently, and I guess I've come to expect it. Whereas if this is your first Von Trier movie and you weren't ready for it, I can see how that would throw you off balance.
On the plus side, though, I felt that if you compare this to another artsy kind of film we had looked at, like Braid, I felt that the visual representation made more sense here than it did in Braid.
Uh-huh. Right. I agree.
Or what was the other film? Emeritati?
Emeritari?
Yeah, Emeritari. Yeah, because that had the afterlife all too with the weird visuals.
True.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But you're right. That was completely weaved into the storyline. This had at least an idea that we could see how it could fit into this narrative. It's just when it comes to how it presented, I could understand the significance of it versus some in Braid where some of the visuals they were using just felt being artsy for the sake of being artsy rather than having any ties to character or themes.
Mm-hmm.
Right, I see your point.
Well, and it definitely had ties to themes, but maybe not so much characters.
Well, you know what I'm saying, in terms of like, we can kind of see, I mean, when we kind of go versus Jack versus Dante, two different kind of souls experiencing hell in different ways and seeing in different ways, I think that's a kind of an interesting kind of point of view.
Right, right. Well, yeah, I mean, Virgil, because we find out his real name, that's just a nickname for Virgil, is obviously he doesn't have to worry because he's just a person leading someone to hell because that's his job. So he's looking at the whole scenario differently. And as you said, maybe he's being tricky too because he's purposely bringing the quote-unquote victim to the bridge to let them screw up themselves and go to hell, not the ninth level of hell themselves, rather than a lesser hell, because no matter what, their soul's doomed because, for what they had done. While Jack is looking at, like, holy shit, I gotta get the hell out of here. And with his arrogance, he knows that he's scared a little bit, but he still thinks he's gonna get out of this. All the way to the very end. And oddly, his main emotion isn't fear. It's more arrogance. And I thought that was kind of interesting. And then, of course, he falls to that.
Well, it makes sense, too, because of his recurrent trait of narcissism, that he even thinks himself above hell.
Yep.
Explain that once more, Abe.
Well, I'm saying this. One of the traits that he has throughout the film,
he's a narcissist. Yeah,
it's narcissism, and in this case here, he completely sees himself as being above hell's power to hold him.
Yeah, like hell's for other people.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, and that's the thing, right? As a sociopath,
the law's for other people.
Yeah, exactly. So even though I don't even know if he even knows that he's doing the wrong. Because he keeps on explaining throughout the whole movie
that
he keeps saying he doesn't regret anything he's done.
Right. I don't think he has a concept of wrong. He definitely knows he's breaking the law.
Right. Exactly. No doubt about it that he knows he's breaking the law and that he could get caught and whatnot. But I think he thinks those are constructs against his work rather than maybe he's the issue and not the laws.
Right, right.
Yeah. And
sorry, go ahead.
I was just gonna say, and that just shows the narcissism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was going to say there was one brief exchange on their journey to hell that I thought was kind of interesting, which was that Verge tells Jack that he hears a humming noise, and he said that humming noise is all these screaming souls being tormented in hell. And there are so many that it's just you can't distinguish anymore, and it just sounds like a buzz.
Yeah, it's like it's a high frequency sound.
Right, and I found that concept pretty intriguing, and I want somebody to write a story based on that concept about scientists accidentally locating hell because of that noise.
That is actually a pretty cool story idea. And that's the thing, is that, you know, I mean, if you go to a football stadium, which me and Eric have done many times, you know, the people just talking at normal level, it's just this the crowd.
Yeah, 50,000 people doing it. It gets pretty loud.
Right. And then you multiply that by infinity of the human race, you know, from the beginning of the first person's birth.
Mm-hmm.
And how many people have lived on the planet, and assuming you know people have faith, the number that happen to go to heaven versus the number that go to hell, you know, let's say 50-50, we're talking about 50% of every generation since the beginning of time, rather than just 50,000 people in a stadium.
Right.
You know, so you can gather that, yeah, the what type of noise of people screaming for eternity, and you know, every generation 50% are down there. I mean, it's just, yeah, it is an interesting concept.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah, so, and that's pretty much, and then it goes to credits, and that's the film.
Yeah, that's the film.
Yeah, and yeah, so a lot of people, and I know you think it's hogwash, which you're probably right, Eric, but I would be curious to see what Abe thinks of it, even though he's not as familiar with von Trier as an artist, because this is his first film. Rumor it has it that von Trier was making the film as a joke about him being Jack and the people that are being killed and all are like critics, and then the horror of the people watching it, you know, the button pushing was those who dislike him. He's intentionally trying to aggravate. And when he dies at the end, Jack goes to hell at the end. That's basically von Trier saying that this is you, the critics, thinking who I am, which is someone that's a narcissistic pig, and I'm going here.
So, in the way you describe it to me, it just sounds like a cinematic tantrum.
I like that phrase.
That's what it sounds like. It really does. It just sounds like, you don't like my movies. I'm going to make you all the victims of my movie. I don't really, I don't know if I can really see it that way. I mean, maybe to some extent, I'm starting to see how the button pushing could be an idea of him just continuing to do what he wants to do.
Right.
And square everybody else, but I don't know if it really gets to the level of, you know, of a cinematic tantrum. I really don't. I can see how some people can see it that way, but I'm not sure about that. I think it is certainly an idea of how art can be very subjective. What we see as beautiful or seen as acceptable, or what's seen as worthy of being presented, and what isn't. You know, I can certainly see things like that. But I don't know if it, you know, I don't think it reaches like, you know, anything like some kind of vindictive piece. I guess maybe some little frustration kind of radiating from it, considering how, you know, Lars von Trier has struggled with, you know, the reception and everything like that. I just kind of see him just kind of continue to do what he wants to do.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I like your analogy your terminology of cinematic tantrum. But whether partly that's true or not, that, you know, what the critics think that this may actually be is, I think, only a part of it. That's the thing. It's just a part of it.
Well, as I say, from seeing this, I thought it was mostly about him trying to present the argument of what is the value of art in terms of what is objective content and what is something that is acceptable by society standards.
Right. Yeah, and I would agree 100% that is the best theme anyone could take out of this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was I'm on the same page.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's one that, as I said, could be easily missed because it has a heavy, thick ice surface of the serial killer film. But you kind of got to drill through that to kind of find that theme there.
Right. Yeah, yeah. It's like swimming where you got to put your hands out and then push away everything and see what's behind the curtain or whatever, you know. And it's really... that's a good point because the movie is so intense and so dramatic and so philosophical that you could overlook these other aspects that could be, you know, what would be there if you boiled all that away, you know. And that's the thing is the movie automatically gets thrown into as a horror film because of the serial killer aspect of it.
Well,
and it sure should
be. I think that's appropriate.
Yeah, it is. It almost certainly is appropriate. However, there's more than just a slasher here.
I mean, oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I just think I think just from the general audience member that it could completely be missed if they don't look hard enough.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Mm-hmm.
This is not a movie for the masses, for sure.
No, and as we can see from how it was received, that really it's very clear that's how it went.
Well, but you know, at the same time, I'm pretty sure Lars von Trier doesn't give a shit.
Oh, he doesn't give a shit, but it just kind of really shows how people will only look at a film at a surface level, and not try to see a bigger picture by examining it. Little gears and stuff to see the inner workings.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, and that's the thing that makes this film funny is that he shows the film at Cannes and it's overwhelmingly received as an instant classic and there's a 10-minute standing ovation and all this other stuff. And then when it gets seen by the random critic at the Boston Globe or the New York Times or the London Times or the Arizona Republic or wherever, they pan it because it's too brutal or too this or too arty or too whatever. And that really comes down to exactly subjectiveness of the art itself, because why would all these fabulous movie reviewers and intellectuals think it's the most fantastic film they saw at Cannes?
Well,
and then Bozo reviewer at the Chicago Sun-Times says it sucks.
Well, I don't know if it's fair to call them a bozo just because they don't agree with you.
Right.
But
I just like being a bozo.
But I think that it has a lot to do with how people approach criticizing movies. Mm-hmm. Because some people will say that you should try and review movies objectively without letting your own opinions get involved. I think that's, virtually impossible, and B, not the way I want to receive reviews. I want to know what the person writing this thinks, and whether or not they liked the movie. So if they don't like the movie because it's overly violent, then cool. That's their opinion on the movie, and they can review it that way. I don't have a problem with that.
I think it's too is that as you have, because my first Lars von Trier film, so I've not seen a lot of his other films, and some of his style is kind of strange to me. But I think there's those who really were able to kind of get into that kind of style and kind of understand what he was trying to do with it, can really see what is not just a film about pushing buttons, about shocking people. It does have some layers to it. And I think those who see and enjoy it are able to see, you know, see it beyond as a shocking slasher, a serial killer film. You know,
yeah.
I think that's more of it. I think Lars von Trier is kind of very niche. And,
oh, absolutely.
And I think that's part of the reason why that he struggles with, you know, a lot of critics and the general
and
audience.
Financial success.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Now that's true. I mean, for example, this film is so well made that if you just go by that, it should have been at theaters everywhere. But because of the niche that it has, meaning who would watch it, it obviously didn't, and instead went to VOD.
Well, and according to Wikipedia here, the budget on this was 8.7 million euros, which I guess was approximately $9.9 million with the exchange rate at the time. And it only pulled in 2.6 million at the box office. So financially, this was a failure, at least theatrically.
Yeah. And it makes sense because for a number of reasons. One, because it was limited, right? So
yeah.
If you don't play it at theaters, you're not going to get much money out of it. Mm-hmm. And two, it's a niche anyway. You know, you're not going to be playing this in the middle of nowhere, Ontario, and people are going to go, what the hell is this? You know,
right.
Versus someone in New York City who's going to go, yeah, this is my type of film. I must have a martini afterwards.
Wonder to hear somebody say that out loud.
There's probably someone out there that has said it.
Right. I'm sure they did that at cons, right?
Right.
And then it was outraged because they only got two olives and it should have been three. This is outrage.
It's an outrage. All right. Are we ready to wrap this up?
Yes. I guess we'll do probably Melancholia the next time Mike doesn't join us. Because when Mike doesn't join us, this is our opportunity to get some of these good...
Lars von Trier movies in, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And Melancholia is such a great film that with so much to talk about, I think, that I would love to do an episode on that one.
And we'll see if Lars von Trier scared off Abe or not.
That's right.
Well, we'll see. We'll see.
Right. Well, it seems like you understood it pretty well, and based off of how you talk, I would have never guessed that you were just okay with the film.
I think I had enough experience with a lot of the shocking material of horror films that it didn't really deter me too much.
Yeah.
But I also kind of was able to dissect it pretty well. And I think it also because discussing it also helped. It kind of allows ideas and thoughts to kind of bounce off each other to kind of...
Right.
You know,
and I think this is absolutely the type of movie that you think back about in a more positive fashion after you discuss it with other people.
Yeah. Go
ahead. No, you always say something, Phil.
Oh, I was just going to say, Eric, next time we do a Lars von Trier, we should have Dan as a guest host.
I'll invite him if you want me to.
Yeah, I mean, he's into this stuff, so yeah.
No, he's totally into this stuff.
But, Abe, you were going to say something, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I just feel that certain films like these required a lot more examination. I know I sound like a broken record, but surface level is kind of the first obstacle to get overcome when examining a movie, especially one where it tries to kind of take a subgenre or something like that and add something very different. And for the serial killer genre, that's what Lars von Trier tried to do which the house that Jack built.
Well said. All right. Anything else anybody want to bring up?
Nope.
All right, so we'll give our final thoughts. But before we do that, who's this Dan guy? And what do you do with him, Eric?
This Dan guy is a weirdo who for some reason hangs out at my place every weekend. no, he's actually my co-host on a podcast we do together called the Ascanty Podcast. That's spelled A-S-K-A-N-C-I-T-Y. It's a general interest podcast. And you can find it on Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. And a lot of people think that really he's the most interesting part of that podcast because he has very vocal, interestingly presented, sometimes hard to understand ideas.
And Eric, speaking of Ascanty Podcast, that's actually the same month and same year it came out as the first Dark Discussions.
Yeah, that's right. I think I published the first episode of Ascanty on April 20th, 2011, which is almost, we just passed the 1 year, the 8 year anniversary on that.
Right, right. Yeah. And Dark Discussions, first episode, was released on May 22nd, 2011. So just 3 weeks later or so.
But interestingly enough, because I don't have as many co-hosts and I'm the guy that does all the recording and editing and publishing, we have fallen behind Dark Discussions with the number of episodes published because when I'm not here, the show doesn't happen. So every time I've taken a weekend off for the last 8 years, that's an episode that didn't get done. So our total number of episodes has fallen behind Dark Discussions.
Right. And also, since Dark Discussions is not a general topical podcast, we have a few episodes that are in the can that we can release during weeks that we're on vacation.
Yes.
Yes. All right. Sounds good. Let's see.
We do another podcast together, Phil.
Yeah. What is that, Eric?
We are finishing up the final season of You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, Game of Thrones podcast, where we discuss every episode of the show on a weekly basis. This is it, folks. Last season. So if you're interested in what myself and Phil and Mike have to say, download the latest episode of You Know Nothing, Jon Snow.
That's right. That's right. So it's basically a tribute to the great Sansa Stark.
No, Christ. It's Phil ranting like a lunatic about Sansa Stark and Mike and I trying to correct him.
It's also a cheer on for the great Cersei Lannister as well.
Mm-hmm.
No, maybe not.
God, yes. I'm so looking forward to see how this ends. Will Phil have a meltdown if one of them bites it?
Yeah, well, I think one of them's definitely. I think.
Oh, a whole Cersei's bunch of people are dying next week. We'll see who.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Let's see. Now, also. Just an announcement. I kind of let people know a few weeks ago too, but I have a new short story that was published in a new fantasy anthology that just came out called In the Shadow of the Mountain. In the Shadow of the Mountain is a book that has about 20 or so short stories, including mine. And for folks who are listeners of the podcast, they may have heard of MJ Preston, who actually has a story in it as well. The anthology, this is what it says. It says, not every fantasy has a happily ever after. Worlds collapse, kings fall, races fade into distant memory. In the Shadow of the Mountain will take you into the darkest recesses of the human, dwarven, or Valkyrie soul. Dive deep into caverns of mountains and climb to the highest peak, but don't expect to come out the same as when you went in. And my tale, I wrote it a while ago, so I haven't got the contributor copy yet, but I believe it was called The Light Beyond the Churchyard. And it's basically two warrior women heading out to a churchyard, which basically means a graveyard surrounding a church, where a what's the word? How do you say the word?
Necromancer?
necromancer, that's right, happens to possibly be raising the dead and whatever and cults and all that. And so that's the story. So people can check my short story out, In the Shadow of the Mountain. You can find it on Amazon for sure. I guess it's in Kindle and paperback. It's probably on Barnes & Noble as well, but I haven't checked yet. But also folks can read some of my other short stories in Pentagonal Sextet, which I have 5 stories in that. There's 6 authors, 30 stories total, and 5 stories in it are from me, generally horror and cyberpunk, sci-fi horror, stuff like that. All different genres of subgenres of speculative fiction. And then there's a book called Invocations, which is another horror anthology, which I have a short story in that as well. And so people can check some of my writing from Amazon if you so desire. And if you do read it, please email drdiscussions@aol.com and let me know your thoughts. Let's see. And hey, what's the website again for Dark Discussions?
If you want to pay us a visit, go to darkdiscussions.com. All the episodes that we have recorded, or at least most of them, are up right now to be listened to for free. If you want to check out the other podcasts that we have found on the right-hand side, and there are also blogs and other websites that could pique your interest, so just go to darkdiscussions.com and say hello.
All right, very good. And by the time people finish hearing this, Searching for American Gods, the podcast that me and Mike do, is probably wrapped up. And you can find all those episodes on the RSS feed for Dark Discussions Podcast or for Searching for American Gods, an American Gods podcast. And, of course, as Eric mentioned, You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, a Game of Thrones podcast, which is oddly a large portion of our audience found Dark Discussions through our Game of Thrones podcast. So it's definitely something you should check out. And is actually one of the more listened to Game of Thrones podcasts from Stitcher. It's like in the top 20 Game of Thrones podcasts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So people should check that out. I think they're fun to talk about each episode. So, all right. So let's give our final thoughts on the house that Jack built. Let's start with you, Abe.
Well, I might not have liked this movie as much as Phil or Eric, but I still managed to find an appreciation for the work that Lars von Trier put into it. Yes, there's a lot of shocking stuff in there, and it may deter some viewers or many because it does push some buttons. But I think the serial killer stuff is just surface level, and there's a lot to examine and kind of break down. It's not going to be for everybody, though. And the long length can, especially for a slow paced film, could also be exhausting. And it can get a little weird too. But it's not a terrible film. It's not an awful film. It's not something that can be cast aside. I definitely think it deserves at least a watch, especially if you appreciate this director's work, or like surreal and very strange approaches to storytelling. So those are my takes on the film. If you find yourself interested in, or uncertain, you can at least rent it and give it a shot.
All right, very good. For me, it's a really good film. Again, it's going to be for a limited audience because it is a somewhat art house horror film more than straight horror. So even though it's a serial killer film, don't expect a slasher film. It's kind of oddly, if you have to consider it horror, it definitely feels more like Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer than, Jason from Friday the 13th. But it's definitely more art house than even Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer. If you love Lars von Trier, you're all set. This film's for you. If you just like a good horror film, even if it has some odd tangents that are different than the regular slasher, it's still a good one, but just be warned that it's not a typical horror film. If not an art house horror film, it's not a typical horror film. But all in all, I would give it a high recommend. I rated it pretty high. Eric liked it a lot, and that's how it landed up in our aggregate 2018 Best of Dark Discussions Top 10 Horror Films of the Year last year. So definitely worth checking out, and a really good film. Eric?
I really like this movie. I would recommend it to people who are interested. That might sound a little weird. But there's a baked in group of people that just aren't going to want to watch this movie. There's people that don't like Lars von Trier. There's people that don't like long movies. This is both. So if you're in that, maybe one of those groups of people, skip it. It's not for you. If you're into Lars von Trier or haven't experienced Lars von Trier and think you might want to check it out, I would encourage you to do so. And if you're into watching skilled filmmakers use their technical skills to produce really stunning visual images, this is definitely something you should look at.
All right, very good. So 2018, Lars von Trier's film, The House That Jack Built, starring in an amazing performance, Matt Dillon. It's available everywhere. And as Eric mentioned, if you want the extended cut, or what I guess is called the director's cut.
Yep.
It is available at least on Amazon, if not the other places, through VOD. The disc, I'm not sure if it's released yet.
It's not. I checked because I wanted to buy the director's cut on disc, but it wasn't available yet.
Yeah, so it's still waiting to be placed on Blu-ray, hopefully, or 4K or something. Hopefully it'll come soon. But at least you have the option to rent or purchase it VOD anywhere, and not to promote one company over any other company. But if you are looking for the extended director's cut, Amazon has it for $12.99 VOD. Is that right, Eric? At least
I think so. I can't remember the price off the top of my
head. Yeah, and to be honest,
but I know I got it from Amazon.
Yeah, and the price doesn't matter because as we know, the price changes up. You know,
it's depending. It's below $15.
Yeah, there you go. All right, sounds good. So once again, thanks for listening to Dark Discussions, and email us your opinions at darkdiscussions@aol.com and what you think of this film, and let us know your opinions of Lars von Trier, The House That Jack Built, Matt Dillon's performance, or any of the meaning behind the film that we may have not touched that you feel could add to this conversation, and we will read your email on the website. I mean on the podcast, and also you could also post on Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group and start a conversation there about this film, because I'm sure this film has a lot of things to talk about, and I know a lot of folks on that Facebook group have seen the film and felt it was fairly good. So with all that stated, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right. Thanks for tuning in and listening to us talk about The House That Jack Built. Come back next week. We'll have another topic. Hit the road.
If you say so, I'll have to pack my things and go.
That's right. Hit the road, Jack, and don't you come back no more, no more, no more, no more. Hit the road, Jack, and don't you come back no more.
What you say?
Hit the road, Jack, and don't you come back no more, no more, no more, no more. Hit the road, Jack, and don't you come back no more.
Oh, baby, don't you treat me this way, 'cause I'll get back on my feet someday.
I don't care. gonna try to find myself.
Find yourself. Well, if you do, and when you do,
get lost.
Who, me?
That's right, get lost.